Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
All right. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining us today for a conversation around commercial real estate investing. Every week, we bring you market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. Be sure to visit us as well at www.yieldstreet.com and sign up so you can stay up to date on all of our latest offerings and content. In case we haven't met before, my name is Peter Kerr, and I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. And actually sitting alongside me at Yield Street headquarters is Mitch Rosen, head of our real estate platform, who many of you are familiar with.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Today, we're excited to be joined by Richard Litton, president of Harbor Group International, a leading commercial real estate manager with $12.7 billion in assets under management. Richard, welcome, and thank you for taking the time to sit with us.
Thank you. Great to be here this afternoon.
So with that, let's start the show. Richard, perhaps you could start by walking us through your background as well as your role at Harbor Group.
Sure. I've been with the firm over 17 years now and serve as the president of Harbor Group International. In my role, I sit as the chair of the investment committee as well as sitting on the executive committee and our operations committee. I work with a number of our institutional investors who deploy equity with us, and then spend a lot of time working with our transactions group, thinking about our investment strategies and the best opportunities we might see at any given time.
Well, that's great. Thank you. So maybe it would also be helpful for our listeners to learn a little bit more, you know, who is Harbor Group International?
Sure. So Harbor Group, as you mentioned, it currently has $12.7 billion of assets under management. And that's been accumulated over a slow and steady period of time. We've been in this business for over 35 years. And I think that's one of Harbor Group's hallmarks is that we have a very, very long track record as a firm, started by operating and managing other owners' properties. So we cut our teeth and learned the real estate business by actually getting our fingernails dirty and operating the real estate. Then began to invest, principally in multifamily and in Southeastern and Mid-Atlantic markets. After accumulating a multifamily portfolio, started to expand into the multi-tenant office sector in the late 90s. And then by, you know, roughly 2005, 2006, had several billion of assets under management. And at that time, about 50-50 between multi-tenant office and multifamily. Really, out of the great financial crisis, the sort of 07 through, to call it 2010 period, was a very important time in the firm's history, and fortunately a time where we actually grew significantly, not given the challenges in the market. So we saw debt opportunities during that cycle. So that's when we started our debt platform by investing in real estate bonds in 2008 and 2009. And that experience led to significant growth in our debt platform, which extends to today in a lot of different types of debt investments. And we also felt like coming out of the great financial crisis that the fundamentals in multifamily would be much stronger than in multi-tenant office, particularly in the secondary markets where at the time we had a lot of multi-tenant office buildings. So that very much influenced where we are in our investment platform today. So you'll see us, of that 12.7 billion of assets under management, you know, over 80% of that is in some form of multifamily investment. Could be directly owned apartments, but also a very significant debt investment platform. And to the extent our ownership continues in multi-tenant office, we've really focused on the gateway core liquid markets. So almost all of our multi-tenant office buildings are either in Manhattan, San Francisco, or London. We do also own single-tenant assets, you know, long-term leased, high cash flow assets, and we'll certainly expand to different markets for that type of portfolio. So we built that, I think, assets under management, I think, thoughtfully and sequentially as real estate operators and really taking a real estate owner and operator focus. We are a private company, which we think gives us a lot of advantages and flexibility to not be beholden to the public equity markets. And also, very important, I think, to our success has been the management team's experience together. So it's one thing to be in the real estate business. It's another thing to be in the real estate business a long time. It's another thing for the senior executives to have worked together a long time. So of our eight members of the executive committee, I have the second shortest tenure of the eight, and I've been 17 years, meaning seven of the eight have been working at the firm together for 17 years or more. So we're using all of that collective experience working together and in the real estate markets to really think about where we best position ourselves and find the best risk-adjusted returns.
And that's a lot of market cycles. Yeah.
Exactly. Also very important to our story is performance and experience through market cycles. That's a great point, particularly in a COVID environment.
Hey, Richard, you touched on a lot of that. That was the first of a fantastic, I think, background for our listeners today, right, who may not be familiar with who you are and what Harbor Group has done over a 35-year period, which again is a very long track record of success in a long period of time with different cycles, with different opportunity sets. Can you speak quickly a bit to multifamily sector in particular, because you are, like you mentioned, you are vertically integrated. You do manage most, if not all, of your properties to date. What insight that provides for you as you think about investing in that sector and the advantages that provides versus a traditional financial buyer who may hire a third-party manager to run the property for them and utilize more leverage? It's just a different mindset, I think. So I understand.
I think that's a great point, and it's really kind of a ground up way to think about investing in apartments. And it all starts with the real estate. What are the sticks and bricks of the asset? What is the exact location in a particular submarket of that asset? What are the long-term economic drivers for the submarket? What sort of supply pressures might you face? What are the rents relative to the mortgage costs of single family housing as you think about tensions between home ownership versus renting? We really dig into all of those, that analysis and all of those analytics as the first step. And then once we've made that real estate determination, which is a determination we think we're adept at making after 36 years of operating apartments, then we can decide what's the best way to invest in a particular asset. Is it to own it directly? Is it to make a whole loan to another owner? Is it to play it in between and provide preferred equity or mezzanine? So those investment decisions about how to invest in a particular asset or market, you know, come second after we first thought about, understood, and underwritten the fundamentals of the real estate itself. And to your point about being different from a financial firm, not only are we, you know, an operator of real estate ourselves through our management company platform, it's the same investment team that's making those investment decisions about whether to do direct equity, whether to make a loan. You know, there are firms that have one team or one silo that's just buying the real estate and a completely different team. And it might be a team that has a bond background or a credit hedge fund background, and they're making the debt investments.
That's true. Yeah.
We're working together as an integrated team, the same investment professionals, right, to then make the decision about the right place to invest.
Right. And you have the flexibility to do both. Some, you mentioned other platforms, right? They may have very different pools of capital to target those different sectors.
Exactly.
Right. Which is, right,
exactly.
Which is,
yeah.
Sure. Yep. So Mitch, I do want to turn over to you, but before I do, you know, Richard, there's one thing you mentioned that really kind of piqued my interest. So when you talk about investing across the capital structure, right, you might lend or even own the property outright. Could you maybe walk us through, you know, as head of the investment committee, how you sort of view the risk rewards in any one opportunity for making that determination?
Yeah, so it's a good question. Obviously, when you own the real estate directly, you've got the ups, you've got the upside versus a debt investment where you're going to have a capped return. So to own real estate, we have to see significant upside. You know, that's the capital that's most at risk in any real estate investment is the equity, the common equity. So to be rewarded for that risk, there has to be a material upside story. So to the extent we see those types of opportunities and they come in lots of shapes and sizes, we'd love to own the real estate. That's what we've done the most of for 36 years. But there could be a case where very good real estate, very good market, but at any given point in the market cycle, we don't really see the upside of hitting our equity type returns, but we would love to be in the debt, generate good cash flow, and feel like we're very much rewarded on a risk, you know, a risk adjusted return. So I think that's a lot of how we think about the best and right place to invest. But we also, standing sort of over that from a macro level, we want to have diversity for our investors. We think it's important not just to have diversity by different types of real estate or different types of markets, geographic markets, but to also have diversity within the capital stack that blends together to good risk-adjusted outcomes.
And that's, you know, that's a great point. And I appreciate that answer, Richard. You know, we had a question from a listener now, you know, talking specifically about the crash of 2008, 2009, 2010. You know, I was at a credit fund at the time myself. And the question really more is, you know, what worked for you then at Harbor? And what lesson did you take away looking forward now? I know you mentioned specifically that you accelerated your investments into the multifamily sector on the back of that volatility. Right. But anything else you would share to help answer that question? I could answer myself after you're done with what lessons I learned. Would love to hear your take on that.
So that's a great question. And in any period of market dislocation, your first obligation is to take care of your existing portfolio, take care of your existing investors. And by having an operating company during very difficult times and having that experience of owning and operating real estate, we were really able to weather the storm. And the lessons learned were you take care of the physical asset first and foremost, even if that has some ramifications in the short term for cash flow distributions to investors. Long-term value is created by protecting the real estate, the physical bricks and sticks. Don't use too much leverage. So many people got hurt so badly during that 08-09 period because deals were too highly leveraged. And we were very fortunate to have used moderate and prudent leverage. So if you've got prudent leverage and you take care of the real estate, you can weather that type of downturn. And then when you're able to come out of it, if you're in good markets, good liquid markets, then you can capitalize, not only survive, but make money. And so we felt like we had bought good real estate in good markets. And once we came through that financial crisis, not only did we think we would do well, we were, you know, really, really pleased with those outcomes in that part of the market cycle.
And what the takeaway that I have from what you answered, Richard, is leverage. The key word there was leverage, right? I was more of at a lending shop back in the day when this had happened. And the inherent leverage, both at an asset level and at a fund level, right, whether it be debt and or equity, was quite extreme. The cost of debt was so cheap, yields were so compressed that, you know, folks were levering up to 85%, 90% loan to cost, and even pro forma underwriting, like looking forward, where's NOI going to go down the road versus where it was now? So that's a really key point. Do you want us to speak briefly to how you think about leverage in general in the portfolio looking forward and, you know, fixed versus floating, duration, stuff
right.
like that?
Right, right. And I think one thing you made a terrific point about fund level leverage on top of asset level leverage and kind of over leveraging a portfolio, because in addition to taking care of our portfolio during that cycle, we had some great outcomes, and some of the best outcomes were for sellers who had to liquidate out of a fund because of leverage pressures. And we were able to buy at really terrific, you know, great real estate at terrific cap rates that we had a high conviction we'd do well. So that was a way in which we were able to be very opportunistic on the investment side. And in terms of how we think about leverage, you know, first we think about it on a blended firm basis, because there are multifamily investments, there are some of the office investments I mentioned, and then there are debt investments. Our debt investments have little to no leverage, almost no leverage. So we're not playing the leverage game by and large on our debt book. We'll use it if it's smart and prudent and makes sense for a particular strategy, but it's a very low levered part of our business.
Got it.
And our single tenant office business, or even the couple multi-tenant office deals we've done, we're sticking to like 60-65% leverage. And on multi, we might sometimes go to, you know, more like 75. So on a blended firm basis, we're more like in the high, you know, mid-50s, maybe the high 50s on leverage. And we don't use preferred equity mezzanine loans behind that senior debt. So we're not having different layers of debt or debt-like products to jack up that leverage. Everything else behind any senior financing is all common equity.
That's great. Okay. That's very, very helpful. And that's actually a pretty detailed response. I think that makes a lot of sense. So people can get their arms around that and decipher that, you know, I think quite coherently. We got another follow-up question, which maybe speaks more to when you think about the landscape of opportunities, particularly in the U.S. multifamily sector. Some folks talk about the smile states. Some people talk about the Southeast as being very attractive. Florida, you know, no state tax states. Mm-hmm. Do you have a quick thoughts or anecdotes on what you are targeting, maybe what you're avoiding, that folks can get a sense of your investment strategy looking at the U.S. multifamily market in particular?
Yeah, we're leaning into the smile states, as you call them, and that's because of fundamentals that help drive high occupancies and high rents. And that is states that have, you know, certain business and regulatory environments and or economic, you know, drivers that we think are attractive. And really what it's ultimately about is where are people moving? Where are people going? Where do people want to live? Where do they want to send their kids to school? So you just see a lot of population migration, and it's very well documented, into markets like, you know, Atlanta, the Florida, major Florida markets, the major Texas markets,
yep.
Phoenix. So we do want to lean into that, but that, you know, we're not exclusive there. We think Boston, for example, has some terrific drivers. We think there are places you can play in northern New Jersey that can be very, very attractive. So leaning into the smile states, but not being so macro that we're not very aware of other good opportunities in other markets.
So Richard, to that point, how do you source investment opportunities? You know, if you're not necessarily always looking, you know, if you think about the real estate comes first, you know, and you're certainly not targeting only select states to look at, you obviously have a national approach. How do you go about, you know, sourcing and finding these opportunities?
Yeah. Well, what we prefer to do and try to focus on is opportunities that there's going to be a lot less of a competitive landscape. So, you know, to the extent through our relationships, we know of an owner of a multifamily portfolio, for example, that needs to move quickly because of some distress in the portfolio or some other form of business distress that owner might have. You know, we're trying to get in front of that owner, have a direct one-on-one discussion, and do an off-market transaction that's not going through a brokered or auctioned process. So we like to see those opportunities as much as possible. That can come up in our debt platform. If we've done transactions with another borrower sponsor, they need to move quickly on a new opportunity. That sponsor knows we can execute quickly. And so, you know, the repeat business opportunities that can generate. To the extent things are marketed, you know, where I think we've had our best successes are the very, very large transactions where there are literally only a handful, you know, maybe counted on one hand plus a couple fingers, number of firms that can do transactions of that size. So we've done two $1.8 billion multifamily portfolio acquisitions just in the last little over, you know, 3.5 years. So, and those are two of the five largest in U.S. history. So that's just a very small subset of firms that can execute on those types of transactions.
Yeah. And I would just add, you know, knowing the scale at which Harbor's portfolio spans both geography and just number of units, right? Over 46,000 units. That's as large, if not bigger than some public REITs, right? So just thinking about how scalability of that for folks to who are listening, who don't understand that number, that's just a massive, that's a massive scale. And the access, like to Richard's point, they are probably one of three or four calls when CBRE, Cushman, other are selling a portfolio of a billion plus. Not many folks are buying that kind of scale. So that makes total sense to us. So that's great.
Absolutely. So you also mentioned, Richard, that you know the Harbor has a large focus on multifam properties. But for the other sliver of opportunities that you do look at, can you maybe walk us through what else you all like in the space right now and maybe also contrast that with what you don't like in the space?
Yeah, you mean outside of multifamily?
Yeah.
So we do like single tenant office buildings because they provide a really good cash flow source for our investors at on a relatively safe basis, we believe. So if we can find a building with a 12, 13, 14, 16 year lease, a great tenant, preferably an investment grade tenant, put, you know, modest leverage on that, as I mentioned, the 60 to 65%, that provides a great source of cash flow for investors. So we like those opportunities. Got to be a really good real estate market, though. I've mentioned before, we start with the real estate. So sometimes those opportunities come up, you know, in the middle of Nowheresville. That's not interesting to us, no matter how good the tenant or the cash flow might be, because you still have to be comfortable with the real estate. So we do like those opportunities. You know, we're keeping a close eye on potential distressed multi-tenant office opportunities in the gateway markets. Obviously, with COVID, there's been a lot of pressure on landlords in some of those markets, particularly if the buildings have a meaningful retail component or co-working component, where there's been, you know, where it's been difficult, frankly, collecting rent. So to the extent that owners need to sell, need to liquidate, and the risk-adjusted profile makes sense to us, and there's a real distressed opportunity with great upside at a great location and a great long-term market, we would love to, you know, we would love to do that. Certainly keeping a close eye on industrial as well, along with multifamily. Industrial has been a very strongly performing sector. So, and we've had a couple of very successful transactions in the industrial sector in suburban New York City. So we're keeping our eye out for more opportunities there as well. Hotels are not for us. That's not something we've invested in well over 10 years now. We as a firm view that as much an operating business as real estate. So there may be distressed opportunities there that make sense, but I think not for us. And we're very, very cautious on retail and would need to feel a lot better about long-term fundamentals in retail to do anything, you know, do anything of significance there. Because our view is that, yes, COVID hurt retail badly and continues to hurt retail badly, but in some ways accelerated a trend that was already unfolding with the Amazon effect and other pressures on retail.
Yeah, I would echo that. We've spoken about that on multiple occasions with regards to other webinars we've hosted talking about our macro thoughts, and I think that's accurate. On the hotel side, I'll touch on it very briefly. I have been pretty constructive looking forward, looking 12, 18, 24 months out, that there is going to be some move for people who've been pent up the last 12 months to get out and travel and see clients, and how stable that recovery becomes. Is it just a hockey stick temporarily and it kind of dips back down, or how that plays out, I think, is yet to be determined. But right. I think your point about it being more an operating business is a very appropriate one, right? It's daily leases, right? It's not the kind of leases that you're used to with multifamily being 1 year typically, or office being multiple years, 5, 10, 15 years. So that makes total sense. Yeah. We had a question.
There could be great opportunities in that type of time frame. It's very important for us to know and understand and have a lot of experience in the real estate itself. And it's just not, hotels just not a sector where we have that experience. So we lean in where we've got experience and a track record.
We have a question that's not the easiest question to answer, but I'll pose it to you maybe in a different way. But, I'm sure not every investment has worked out as you had anticipated for a whole host of reasons, right? COVID being a prime example where, you know, who could have foresaw that and underwritten that risk. But in the past, can you just provide some thoughts as to how you approach the workout process when something does not go well or does not hit targets that you maybe
are looking to set and historically, and talking very broad speaking here, right? Do you look to kind of cut bait and move on? Do you try to work through it? You know, do you bring partners in? What's the company's approach to that?
Yeah, that's a great question and a really important question. I think every investment firm should be asked, because sometimes it's easy to just throw up your hands, blame it on the market and move on. But just as I mentioned in the great financial crisis, our first responsibility was our existing portfolio and our existing investors. That's how we view any asset that doesn't go as well as we might have liked. So we have first and foremost senior executive direct responsibility for working through any assets that have difficulties. So I might have some on my plate at any given time. Our CEO might have someone on his plate, our CFO on her plate. I mean, we take a very direct role and we work like crazy to resolve the situation. And that can be restructuring and renegotiating with lenders. That may be bringing more capital into an asset, as long as we feel great about the new capital and that it gives a better long-term outcome to the existing capital. You know, we'll consider all those things as we work through a situation. But I think it's a critical part of any firm's ultimate long-term success to be able to look investors or lenders or other counterparties in the eye and say, you know, we're going to work this hard if it needs to be worked.
I appreciate that answer. I want to touch on another question that we got a lot of questions coming here, which is good. A lot of engagement. You mentioned migration of folks, you know, to Smile States is a prime example that you mentioned. You highlighted that.
Mitch, could you elaborate for the audience? What are the Smile States?
Sure. You take a map of the U.S. and you kind of make a smile running from, you know, Seattle, Oregon, south down to California, going then east through Arizona, through Texas, Alabama, going into Florida, and then back up the eastern coast. Those are traditionally viewed as the Smile States. So basically ignoring the middle of the country for the most part. You know, one sector that you didn't talk about, but I was curious to get your sense on is self-storage. And that's been a very, you know, I would say talked about sector within real estate for the last, I'd say 9 to 10 years. People are moving, they're storing their stuff. They are in transition in some capacity. Have you looked at that sector before? Do you have a view on that? It's okay if you don't. Just wanted to, it was a question I got asked and I'm curious what you thought about it.
No, I appreciate the question. It's not something we focused on and looked at. And that would be in the category of, you know, not having had that experience and background in that sector. You know, it's just not something we've chosen to focus on. We've tried to look a little more at outgrowths of what we do have long-term history in. So when you have long-term history in multi-tenant office buildings, you can parlay that experience into multi-tenant industrial, or you could parlay multifamily experience into single-family rentals, which is something we've looked actively at, for example. So, you know, think about our core strengths in operating the types of products we've operated, and then outgrowths of those opportunities are where you're going to see us focused on any new initiatives.
And I would just say the way I think about how I've approached the CRE space for Yield Street is that, you know what you're good at and you know maybe what you're less experienced in. And if you either educate yourself and learn, or you bring a partner in who's done it multiple times and knows it really well, right?
Exactly.
So I think you're speaking that truth for yourself is really what you're highlighting, right? I mean, you've not done it before. You don't know it as well. You know certain sectors quite well, and let's continue to grow what we know well and maybe take less time to spend on the ones we don't know as well.
Exactly.
Richard, I have a question. I was wondering maybe if you could also sort of contextualize the different environments from, let's say, mid-2019, maybe to middle of last year versus now, and how you're seeing the opportunities relative to those two previous periods.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, we came out of 2019, early 2020, you know, really focused on some very large portfolio acquisitions in the multifamily space in the Smile States, you know, leaning into some of those trends. We're fortunate to get some very good transactions done by, you know, January 2020, February 2020. And then obviously the world experienced a shock in every way with COVID-19. So what did we do this time a year ago, for example? If you think back to this time a year ago, what an upside down state the world and the markets were in. Again, focus on the existing portfolio. Take care of your existing investors and your existing portfolio. You know, we were cutting expenses. It was not a time to be jacking up rents, you know, renovating units and trying to get $300 rent increases based on, you know, appliance packages and new things. So that was not an environment to do that. So we put capital plans on hold. We focused on occupancy. We worked with tenants to take care of government stimulus programs, really just completely pivoted in that environment about operating our, how we operate our multifamily portfolio, and just really, really fortunate to have had such a successful year in terms of performance of what we already owned. In terms of other opportunities where we saw dislocation, where we saw opportunities was not to directly buy, but in the debt space. There were debt holders of apartment-backed bonds, for example, that had to liquidate. They had other liquidity pressures they had to liquidate. We did some great trades in that space. There was a period of time where some lenders went to the sidelines, some debt funds that generate whole loans on apartments. We started a whole new whole loan or bridge lending platform during the middle of COVID to take advantage of a market opportunity. So using multifamily experience, but expanding our product offerings during those challenging times to be able to offer more types of opportunities to our investors. So, you know, that's been a great platform for us that's really gone from zero to working quickly towards being a $1 billion business for us already in less than a year. Then as the markets settled, the economy began to recover, certainly with the vaccine news, and there was a path forward to full economic recovery, we started looking hard at real estate again and did close some real estate direct acquisitions in the multi and single tenant space at the end of last year and in the first quarter of this year. But, you know, as always, just making sure the opportunities make sense relative to the risk.
That's a very nice sequential, you know, timeline, frankly, of what's happened for most folks the last, you know, 24 months. We have another question I wanted to touch on real quick, Richard, and sure. I don't want to name specific names, but the question really focuses around the competitive landscape within particularly the sectors that you are larger in, multifamily being one, right? You know, you mentioned what differentiates you. I don't want to speak for you. I'll let you answer the question yourself, but you mentioned like size, scale, right? The ability to transact at a $1 billion plus purchase price, right? When you think about it, you mentioned two of the last five have been the biggest that you've done yourself. What is it that you think has separated you in those instances besides just able to write a check of that scale? You know, that'd be helpful for, I think, people who are trying to understand, not special sauce per se, but really what's led to that success and the being able to kind of transact at that size, which is, you know, massive.
Sure. That's a great question. I think it's really comes from a very long-term history of, and we say this all the time, doing what we say we're going to do. You know, we're not the right buyer for every deal. You know, somebody may come to us and say, we're willing to award you this opportunity, but you got to pay X. If that doesn't work for us, we pass. So we have a history of performing and doing what we say we're going to do. Those types of transactions also to win them, you not only have to be obviously competitive on price, you've got to commit to move quickly because sellers want to have certainty of execution. They don't want protracted, drawn out processes. And we have a long history of really rolling up our sleeves and working so hard to be thoughtful and extremely careful, dot every I, cross every T, but ultimately get to closing in a very expeditious time frame compared to what others can do. And that probably more than anything has gotten us those large transactions.
Yeah, you. I would say, in my experience, if you're not the best price, but you're the best partner for someone who's selling and gets confidence, you know, that's often worth more than the incremental 1-3% of potential proceeds.
And we think it allows us to buy it at a cheaper price too,
right?
To put that certainty on the table. There are people in the business, and they will say they'll do something just to get an opportunity tied up with really no intention of actually executing on the terms they've offered. And that's not how we've built a reputation or our reputation over 36 years.
I have one last question I want to hit on to see if any others come in, but this is more of a personal question in the sense of how you think about the current environment, particularly the stock market and the correlation of the stock market and the broader macro backdrop with regards to commercial real estate and the asset classes that you typically have invested in historically. Do you have a sense of how you think about that? You know, the advent of guys, other apps out there where you can trade stocks, almost like a game, if you will. You know, I'm in a cab and the cab driver is talking about stocks. That typically means to me that there's probably an overabundance of optimism in the marketplace. How do you think about the stock market backdrop, particularly the last 12 to 14 months and where we are now and how that's impacting, you know, commercial real estate?
Yeah. I mean, I doubt there's much dispute that certainly stock market valuations have been driven in part recently, or maybe materially in part by fiscal and monetary policy that has put so many trillions of dollars into the system, driven interest rates and yields so low, and so that there is in some sense a surge for yield. So that's certainly been part of it. So I would tell anyone in any investment, stock, real estate, or otherwise, what are the fundamentals of the underlying company or opportunity, and where are those fundamentals, you know, where are those fundamentals headed? So, and that's certainly what we think about, is not today, but we certainly think about the conditions today and market conditions today, but what are the fundamentals for a particular opportunity going to look like 1 year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now? What is the right holding period for that investment? How are you gonna execute? So thinking about all that when you make the investment decision is critical. And say the same thing about picking any one stock.
I agree. Yeah, that makes total sense. One other question I had was just, you know, we've heard a lot of sentiment around some of the industries or sectors that everyone's pretty positive on or bullish on, and then also retail, hotels kind of linger as ones that people are less positive about. But what are maybe some of either the macro or real estate risks that aren't being discussed, or even on an industry or sector specific basis? So what really aren't people talking about enough?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it goes back to what I said about what are the ultimate fundamentals and long-term fundamentals, you know, because we have historically low interest rates. We have a lot of capital available that tends to drive a lot of transaction activity in real estate and in other investment classes. But what really are the longer term fundamentals? What is going to cause a particular apartment property in Scottsdale, Arizona to remain occupied and grow rents over 2 to 3, 4 years, or any other market or opportunity we might be looking at? And I think that can sometimes get lost in an environment where there's so much capital and people, you know, feel the need or the desire to put out that capital with maybe a shorter term horizon, as opposed to, you know, to thinking about what the long-term impacts of the economy will be. And that, you know, and that includes thinking about inflation, thinking about future interest rates, and a lot of the commentary you read about today, you know, given how much fiscal and monetary stimulus there's been.
I would just add my thoughts on that real quick, not to digress from what Richard said, but, you know, real estate typically moves and has oftentimes bigger space between peaks and troughs, right? So it doesn't move in the same manner that that a daily traded instrument like a stock would trade, right? So the gaps between the peaks and troughs are longer. Often there's underlying leases. So the impact of something like COVID's not a great example. The impact of something like 08 rarely is like an immediate impact. It takes time for that to play out. Companies downsize, companies move, the tenants go out of business, consumers or renters can't afford their rent. They go down in rental price points. Like this takes months and or years to play themselves out. And so real estate's a longer investor's game, right? These don't move in 3 months, 6 months, where you see this massive rise in NOI or, you know, revenue as an example. It takes time to work it. And that partly talks to Harbor's, frankly, they're managing those assets, right? They're doing it themselves. It's not a third party doing that. And that's any asset class. That's office, that's multifamily, that's retail. You have to work the asset to garner the best value creation for the investors and for the ultimate property itself. So I think that's just a very important point that, you know, these assets don't pop in 6 months where you just see an NOI drop meaningfully. The only one you can maybe see that in is hotel, where you can see a dramatic shift in demand and you can reset your daily rate literally every day. If you're a locked in lease with an office tenant for 10 years, the market moves 25%, you could sell the asset, but you really can't monetize that increase in market rent because you're a locked in tenant, right? So that's something people need to understand.
Yeah, good. All good points.
Yeah. So we're actually running out of questions here and getting close on time here with Richard. I do want to turn it back over to you and see if you had anything else that you would like to add that maybe we didn't get a chance to share today.
I think it's been a very, very thorough discussion. Appreciate your questions and insight. I've enjoyed the discussion.
Yeah, thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, I always say, Richard, thanks for your time today. Appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and answer these questions. And have a great day, and thanks again.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.